Well, thank you. It's to say the least, it's a real pleasure and privilege to appear before such a distinguished gathering, and I'd like to express my gratitude to Margot Carlyle and Ken Cribb, Diana Denman, all of those at the Philadelphia Society who've made this opportunity possible for both my daughter and myself. I'd also like to thank a guy that is clearly one of the true pillars of the Reagan Revolution and a national treasure, Stan Evans. Stan. Now, not surprisingly, I can't even hope to be as entertaining or amusing as Stan, so by default, I'll dive into the matter at hand. The program, or the title of my talk anyway, is, I think, National Security Dimensions of Global Finance. Well, at the risk of piling on, I'd also like to treat China as an emerging market case in point. But first, I recently finished reading a genuinely moving tribute entitled Flags of Our Fathers, by the son of a Marine survivor of Iwo Jima, John Bradley. I'm sure many here have read it. But as that author took you through seemingly countless anecdotes of agonizing hardships of combat and the tears they inspired, you couldn't help but marvel at the fundamental decency, selflessness, and valor of Americans during World War II. Sacrifice for Americans who remained at home was also a common virtue, as captured by the wartime dictum, use it up, wear it out, make it do, or do without. So too were the purchase of victory bonds by average Americans, who repeatedly answered the call to help invest directly in America's brave fight for freedom. Indeed, on March 7th, 1945, while the brutal struggle for Iwo Jima still raged on, then Representative Mike Mansfield took the House floor to initiate America's seventh national bond tour. Mansfield proposed that the famous photograph of the flag raising over Mount Suribachi be the symbol of that tour, so that in his words, we as a people would do our part in keeping the flag flying at home as they have done in keeping it flying on foreign battlefields. Well, as Ronald Reagan often started his sentences, today it's my sad duty to report that many Americans are often unwittingly buying very different types of government bonds. Those of the People's Republic of China and the Russian government. To date, the total amount of Beijing's and Moscow's sovereign bond offerings in our markets has totaled roughly $17.8 billion. What's worse, few, if any, questions were asked by those investors about where that money, perhaps your money, was going or how it was to be used. The fact is that such things may have been used to reschedule debt or to finance benign commercial projects or activities such as hydroelectric plants. But they may have just as easily been used and employed to help develop and build China's DF-31 and Russia's Topol-M ICBMs targeted at American families. It is, in short, high time that we begin to focus on global bad actors, increasingly funding themselves and their odious international activities in not only the U.S. bond market, but in our stock exchanges as well. As we Americans do so, we need to ask, among many other questions, is our money going to finance that baby food manufacturer or to fund supplier credits for proliferation-related weapon sales to Iran and Iraq? Now, a prime example of the need for what I call a national follow-the-money effort involves the communist government with the most voracious appetite for American capital on the planet, the People's Republic of China. You heard last evening that there's abundant evidence that China has emerged as the greatest threat to the national security of the United States as we enter the 21st century. Like the recent standoff with Beijing over our surveillance aircraft, we Americans didn't cause this to happen. It was destined to eventuate when the Chinese leadership years ago identified us as their principal adversary, or, in their words, their, quote, main enemy, unquote. No false strategic partnership or largely one-sided engagement policy can paper over this unhappy reality. Moreover, Beijing has cast itself as what I call the great enabler with regard to rogue state acquisition of weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missile delivery systems to put at risk U.S. forward deployed forces and ultimately America itself. Now, for the good news. We aren't without policy options concerning what to do about the burgeoning Chinese threat before a crisis is upon us. Strengthening our vigilance and scrutinizing the inherent and emerging weaknesses of this large communist competitor should be first orders of business. In the energy sector alone, China's demand for oil imports will likely double by the year 2010, and that's conservative. Due to Beijing's reluctance, again, just using one sector, to render future Chinese growth vulnerable to the world's spot markets for oil, Beijing has crafted what was until recently a strategically clever foreign oil acquisition strategy. Go to pariah oil-producing states where G7 or industrial democracies can't go or are prohibited from going. Offer large amounts of cash investment, conventional weapons, and/or weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missiles. And in exchange, secure those contracts and oil concessions, which provide China with dedicated physical supplies. That's the plan. It is at least in part pursuant to this strategy that you find Chinese state-owned firms like China National Petroleum Company and Sinopec doing big business in places like Sudan, Iran, and Iraq. But something new has begun to interfere with this dangerous Chinese strategy. A growing coalition of non-governmental organizations with combined memberships, if you can believe it, of as many as 20 million Americans has combined and succeeded in connecting the dots between the operations of PRC energy companies in Sudan and the use these state-owned entities are making of their access to the U.S. debt and equity markets to help finance Beijing's odious partnership with the Khartoum regime. In fact, the business that China's oil companies are doing with Sudan may well emerge as a case study applicable to several other categories of global bad actors, as I call them, seeking to raise funds in our markets through your pension and mutual funds, through your individual portfolios, whether you have an emerging market growth fund or some other international instrument. I'll get to it later, but it's high time we start to look at what's inside. But who are these bad actors? And we've talked about a few examples. Well, let's start with proliferators. Intelligence and technology theft front companies. Foreign firms partnering with terrorist sponsoring regimes, like the Sudan. Advanced weapons manufacturers, including those producing ICBMs. Firms linked to potentially hostile foreign militaries, like the PLA. Arms smugglers, organized crime-affiliated companies, human rights abusers, and religious persecutors, to name a few. Well, the message to me seems straightforward. We urgently need the Securities and Exchange Commission to strengthen transparency and disclosure requirements in our markets so that American and other investors know the true identities and global activities of the foreign firms, governments, and senior managements in whom they're being asked to invest. If we as a nation were to pay greater attention to the destination of our funds, we would likely inflict serious costs on global bad actors, causing them to face possibly acute financial shortfalls. On the other hand, if we continue to turn a blind eye toward multi-billion dollar American financing of potential adversaries and wrongdoers, we will almost surely not only jeopardize vital security interests, but perhaps over time, our very survival as a nation. Consider the following examples. Many of you remember the notorious Wang Jung, chairman of the People's Liberation Army's huge weapons trading company, Polytechnologies. You heard passing reference to this case last night. Poly was caught by federal authorities attempting to smuggle some 2,000 AK-47s to West Coast street gangs in 1996. Wang Jung is reportedly ineligible to receive a visa to enter our country. What you may not know is that Wang Jung is also chairman of a $27 billion trading company called China International Trust and Investment Corporation, or CITIC. Now, Wang Jung CITIC, to put this argument in perspective, is currently $800 million deep in our bond market. Can't get a visa to enter the United States, but he may be in any one of your bond portfolios. Affiliated companies of CITIC, CITIC Pacific, CITIC Kawa Bank, are held by some of this nation's largest public pension funds, including CalPERS. Now, next, for those familiar with the human catastrophe underway in Sudan, where the Khartoum regime is engaged in the wholesale slaughter of Christians and animists in the south of that country, the name China National Petroleum Company is of signal importance. It's a 40% shareholder in what they call the Greater Nile Petroleum Operating Company, Sudan's oil consortium. They have one. It's the cash cow of Sudan's genocide, slavery, and terrorist sponsoring Islamic extremist government. Now, CNPC and a hastily configured subsidiary, PetroChina, launched in September of 99 what turned out to be an 8-month campaign intended to raise the largest initial public offering of stock in New York Stock Exchange history. I mean, this is not subtle. $10 billion. The vigorous opposition of a non-governmental coalition of organizations from across the political spectrum. And believe me, you'd be shocked if you heard some of the names in this. I mean, Friends of the Earth, AFL-CIO, Reagan National Security types, the International Campaign for Tibet, the U.S. Business and Industrial Council, a very wide spectrum indeed, which the Casey Institute helped coordinate. Together with some thoroughly warranted market skepticism, slashed that $10 billion IPO to under $2.9 billion, a 71% downgrading of that offering. Nevertheless, it's still held by some 40 or more of the major funds in this country, including, reportedly, Pennsylvania's public pension system. Now, I began this talk with a reference to Chinese sovereign bond offerings in the U.S. Perhaps some in Beijing would term these Chinese victory bonds. Well, these totally undisciplined cash borrowings by the Chinese leadership directly, available for application to any purpose that they deem indicated, they alone deem indicated, are a source of obvious concern. The latest effort to tap into the American investor community was scheduled for November of last year in the amount of $1 to $2 billion. The so-called PetroChina Coalition I just mentioned, made up of these non-governmental organizations from every political stripe virtually, immediately initiated a direct contact campaign with those responsible for over $1 trillion of funds under management in this country, urging them to avoid this undisciplined, imprudent investment. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom went even further. They sent a letter to the President Clinton expressing deep concern over that offering on the grounds that the Chinese government engages in religious persecution. They've sent the same letter, stronger, to President George Bush, because this is yet to finish unfolding. These coordinated efforts, almost all conducted outside of government, were primarily responsible for the withdrawal by Beijing of that sovereign bond offering later in November of last year. Unfortunately, all things being equal, it's merely a matter of time before Beijing will try again. And I'd bet a good portion of my net worth, such as it is, that it will be this year. Now, there are several other troubling cases of the wrong sorts of Chinese government-affiliated enterprises in our markets, not to mention Russian companies like Gazprom and Lukoil, not to mention that Iran's coming back to the bond market for the first time in 25 years. I mean, you name it, and they're on their way to the biggest pot of dough in the history of the world, where every other stock and bond market, every other capital market in the world combined might not be the size of ours. Maybe, but maybe not. Anyway, we dominate this area of global finance still. But clearly the shortness of time is not going to permit any more examples than the ones I've provided. And believe me, I realize that I'm speaking to a very free market-oriented group here. But let me assure you that in urging remedial actions to redress these emerging challenges posed to our national security, human rights, and religious freedoms and other values, I am as anxious as you are to avoid capital controls, undue government intervention in the markets, and other measures which could impede the free flow of capital into or out of the United States. I recognize that our vibrant markets are the envy of the world and represent a pillar of our global competitiveness. No chill or shadows are being proposed be cast across our markets to the benefit of global markets elsewhere, I might add. Indeed, this is precisely why the Casey Institute of the Center for Security Policy has pursued over the past 5 years what we've called our Capital Markets Transparency Initiative. By concentrating on limited but highly significant policy prescriptions, such as strengthening SEC disclosure requirements and encouraging the voluntary expansion of due diligence risk assessments by the fund managers of this country to incorporate national security, human rights, religious freedom, and other new forms of political risk. We've sought to remain consistent with market forces and practices. Only in the most egregious circumstances have we felt compelled to oppose a specific foreign firm's or government's stock or bond offering. I needn't tell this audience that more transparency and discipline is a good thing for investors, particularly with regard to emerging market enterprises. Moreover, expanded political risk assessments represents what I think of as a normal evolution of the marketplace, since these challenges simply haven't been on our radar screen before. Taking a stand on a specific foreign equity or debt offering, however, when there is an inordinate risk that U.S. investor money could go, for example, to help finance genocide, terrorism, proliferation and slavery in Sudan, I would argue is a moral and civic duty, as well as a prudent financial decision. After all, even from a purely financial perspective, if you didn't care about these other considerations, if your conscience wasn't particularly bothering you, divestment and IPO opposition campaigns of the scale that I'm talking about, not to mention the prospect of U.S. government sanctions always hanging over those investments, can depress the value of those targeted foreign securities. In short, it's not good business. Fortunately, the executive branch and the Congress are now actively exploring this potent new policy tool. Unlike trade sanctions, which typically require, I think we'd agree, and increasingly agree, an unachievable level of multilateral cooperation, seeing last time I checked, Europe and Asia weren't stepping up exactly to help us in economic sanctions of any variety. That's not new. That goes back to the old days as well. But it also, these trade sanctions, as we know, can inflict significant collateral damage on U.S. interests, exports, jobs, profits. Well, rarely applied capital market sanctions avoid the bulk of these shortcomings. Last time I checked, there were no underlying trade transactions. There were no exports or jobs or people-to-people contact hanging fire. It was cash with no questions asked. That's what the cap markets are about more often than not, as those in the markets know who are here today. So by contrast, thanks largely to the robust opposition of non-governmental organizations, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, key members of Congress, who are increasingly not silent on these matters, China was forced to forego as much as 50%, or some $12 to $13 billion, of what it had planned to raise on the U.S. capital markets last year. Not 5%, 10%, 50%. To put that figure in perspective, China raised a total of $18.6 billion on global capital markets total last year. What was foregone in the United States of that $12 to $13 billion? 66% of that total global figure. In closing, Thomas Paine once said, quote, "Those who expect the blessings of liberty must undergo the fatigues of supporting it," unquote. Well, my colleagues and I happen not to think that it's too fatiguing for American investors and fund managers to insist on knowing where their money is going and how it's being used. Likewise, we don't think it's an imposition to urge the SEC to broaden disclosure requirements to account for these valid new market risks for investors. And finally, a growing number of us are convinced by the facts that if we as a nation of investors, entrepreneurs, and decent patriotic working folk fail to undertake these highly achievable tasks, we will end up unwittingly underwriting our very liberties. Thank you very much.